You know how classic car guys like to get together and park all their hot rods in a row? They line them up and pop the hoods and then just sort of stand back and admire? Well, these guys are pretty much the same way, except with banjos.
That's the high end.
Yeah, the
greatest one. It's this beautiful bird's eye maple, you know, just the proportions are so right on with this sort of classical architectural ornament along the edge of the neck. Really just gorgeous and in good shape.
Pete Ross and his friends Bob Winans and Greg Adams stare lovingly at a row of banjos. Really old, fragile, yellowed banjos. The instruments lay head to neck on a long table in an archive room at the Baltimore Museum of Industry. Soon, these artifacts will hang on the walls for the museum public to admire. They are going to be the star attractions in a new exhibit called Making Music: The Banjo in Baltimore and Beyond. William Boucher Jr. was the man who made most of these banjos in a shop on Baltimore Street.
He immigrated here from Germany, preceded apparently by his father, who was also in the music business, and his father had set up a shop here. His father was also a professional singer, and both of them and many other members of the music community in Baltimore mid 19th century, 1840s, were German immigrants. There was a large community of German immigrants in Baltimore.
As banjo historian Bob Winans explains, this German guy, Boucher, is interesting because back in the 1840s, he saw a new musical craze developing, and he capitalized on it.
There is a background here that sort of leads up to Boucher grasping a moment in time.
That background, stated bluntly, is this.
The result of the banjo in this region is specifically because of slavery.
That's banjo historian Greg Adams. As he points out, what we know today as the banjo dates back to the first West Africans who were enslaved and brought to the Bahamas. They arrived in chains with nothing, but they brought with them a cultural memory, the know-how to build and play a small plucked lute made from a gourd calabash stretched with animal hide. It was called the bonza. The instrument you're hearing right now is being played by Pete Ross. He also built it. It's a meticulous reproduction based on a Haitian bonza collected back in 1840. This is the closest thing in existence to the sound that actually rang out on sugar plantations in the Bahamas hundreds of years ago. And, following not long after, on plantations across the Chesapeake.
I think one of the reasons we are so obsessive about our research in this stuff is because we can't have a time machine to just see the stuff that we're dying. It feels like it's just out of sight, you know.
It was at PG County, 1749, a Negro man named Scipio.
That's the first use of that spelling of the word.
Ross, Winans, and Adams lean in and peer together at the block type of an escaped slave notice in a news bulletin from Prince George's County, Maryland, 265 years ago. The word they're talking about is spelled B-A-N-J-O.
There are at least 17 or 18 different ways of spelling that word.
Winans is well acquainted with all the variations. He pored through historical literature from the era, and every time he found a mention of the banjo, he noted where it was mentioned, and he put a corresponding pin on a map of the U.S. When you look at the map, most of the pins are stuck right around the Chesapeake, which, our historian points out, brings us back to that German banjo builder, William Boucher Jr.
Just seeing that cluster of these earlier references, going right up to the time just before Boucher arrives, he's arriving into an area where the banjo is well known.
So just to recap, immigrant entrepreneur instrument maker sets up shop in Baltimore at a historical moment when, number one,
people who had played banjos before this time were playing homemade banjos.
And number two,
the people who were playing those banjos during this pre-industrial time were African Americans.
So why, you have to wonder, did Boucher see a market for banjos? At his shop on Baltimore Street, he was already building and selling a lot of other instruments. Here's Greg Adams reading from a Boucher advertisement from 1852.
And it says, William Boucher Jr., manufacturer and importer of musical instruments. They give the location. where they will find constantly on hand accordions, French and German, flutinas, guitars, Spanish, French and German, violins, Italian, French and German, violoncellos, with and without patent heads, flutes, fifes, flageolets, clarinets, castanets, bones, drums, mutes, musical boxes, triangles, mouth harmonica, all sizes,
etc., etc. So, again, with an inventory like this, why bother building a commercial version of a homemade instrument played by enslaved Africans? The answer is ugly.
Its commercialization is an extension of the phenomenon of blackface minstrelsy.
There's a timeline of minstrelsy, probably going back, white guys putting on blackface, black makeup, and imitating African Americans, basically mocking them in sometimes really ugly ways, going back to what the 1790s. It's picking up more and more. It's part of our culture. They're playing in small theaters. They're playing as parts of circuses. In the late 1830s, Joe Sweeney from Appomattox, Virginia, becomes a blackface performer, but he also brings with him a banjo that he had made, and he had learned how to do so and how to play it from slaves near where he had grown up. And that then becomes an element of blackface performance. And we can also say in this period, the 19th century, throughout maybe the early 20th century, the banjo is almost an ugly icon of African-American culture, along with fried chicken, watermelon, and straight razors. You know, it was just seen as this thing that was another part of what, you know, those people over there, it's one of the symbols of African-Americans. The funny thing is, a few years after Joe Sweeney brings a banjo into his performances, you know, minstrelsy really blows up with a straight-up band, the Virginia Minstrels. They have a fiddle, they have a banjo, they have bones and tambourine. It's like a modern rock band.
Except they're all wearing blackface.
And
Singing in faux dialect.
They sing in faux dialect, but they have two lead instruments, two rhythm instruments, like a rock band, and it just blows up. Everybody embraces it. Everybody takes it as their own, regardless of their cultural origins. And America's history is really short. People weren't sure if they were still their immigrant culture or some new culture here. This is a way of saying this is our culture. And when guys started running out and wanting banjos, wanting to play banjos, wanting to sing these songs, even though they were singing them in these black characters, they really took this character onto themselves. And buying a banjo, learning the songs, is almost a way of like buying your authenticity as an American. It's one of the strangest things. You know, it lives to this day. A lot of these songs that we think of as typical country songs, southern songs, were written to be sung as if they were written by a sort of this fictionalized black character of minstrelsy.
And it's really the first American form of entertainment that's not built basically on a European base. And in fact, it's the first place where American musical and theatrical influence goes back to Europe, because the minstrel show was almost immediately exported and became popular in England.
It's pretty gruesome. It's pretty strange that people embraced it the way they did, but that's what happened.
So, for all of us modern-day Americans who associate banjo music with the peace-loving, hand-holding togetherness of the folk revival, this is a bitter pill to swallow. How do we reconcile the banjo of, say, a benevolent, world-saving Pete Seeger with the banjo of a white guy in blackface wearing clownish clothes and plucking along to cartoonishly racist lyrics? People who really, really love the banjo have to confront some serious questions.
How do we take a stand and say, this is part of the broader American experience, and it is time in 2014 and forward for us to be pushing this past forward so we can all figure out how to make better sense out of it?
It's hard to think of an instrument more quintessentially American than the banjo. But once you confront the uglier side of its history in this country, it actually seems somehow, ironically, even more American. The sound of the banjo is the sound of slavery and racism. It's a sound that humbles us in the shadow of our own history. But it's also the sound of resilience, adaptation, a sort of stubborn will to survive the elements. It's woven into the American soundtrack, and if we listen, we end up learning a lot about who we are. For The Signal, I'm Aaron Hinken.